Major Frederick Snell, officer commanding the 3rd Battalion, 1st Regiment, the King's African Rifles, did not look up from the document he was perusing when Lieutenant Leon Courtney was marched under armed escort into his office in battalion headquarters. Snell was old for his command. He had fought without particular distinction in the Sudan against the Mahdi, and again in South Africa against the wily Boers. He was close to retirement age and dreading its arrival. On his army pension, he would be able to afford only a mean lodging in a town such as Brighton or Bournemouth, which for the remainder of their days would have to be home for both him and his wife of 40 years. Maggie Snell had spent a lifetime in army quarters in tropical climes, which had yellowed her complexion, soured her disposition, and sharpened her tongue. Snell was a small man. His once bright ginger hair had faded and fallen out until he was left with only a scraggly white fringe around a freckled pate. His mouth was wide, but his lips were thin. His eyes were round, pale, blue, and protuberant, which justified his nickname, Freddy the Frog. He replaced his pipe between his lips and sucked at it, making it gurgle noisily. He was frowning as he finished reading the handwritten sheaf of papers. He still did not look up, but removed the pipe from his mouth and flicked it against the wall of his office, leaving a splatter of yellow nicotine drops across the whitewash. He put it back in his mouth and returned to the first page of the document. He read it again with deliberation, then laid it neatly in front of him and at last raised his head. "Prisoner, attention!" barked Sergeant Major Mafethi, who commanded the guard detail. Leon stamped his battered boots on the cement floor and stood erect. Snell eyed him with distaste. Leon had been arrested 3 days earlier when he had presented himself at the main gates of battalion headquarters. Since then he had been held on Major Snell's orders in detention barracks. He had not been able to shave or change his uniform. The stubble on his jaw was dark and dense. What remained of his tunic was filthy and tattered. The sleeves had been ripped off. His bare arms and legs were crisscrossed with thorn scratches. But despite his present circumstances, he still made Snell feel inadequate. Even in his rags, Leon Courtney was tall and powerfully built, and he radiated an air of naive self-confidence. Snell's wife, who seldom expressed approval of anyone or anything, had once remarked wistfully on how fetchingly handsome young Courtney was. "He's set a few hearts fluttering hereabouts, I can tell you," she had said to her husband. Now Snell thought bitterly. "No more fluttering hearts for a while. I shall see to that." Then at last he spoke aloud. "Well, Courtney, this time you have outdone yourself." He tapped the wad of papers in front of him. "I have been reading your report with nothing less than wonder." "Sir," Leon acknowledged. "It defies belief." Snell shook his head. "Even for you the events you describe form a low watermark." He sighed, but behind the disapproving expression he was elated. At last this bumptious young shaver had gone too far. He wanted to savour the moment. He had waited almost a year for it. "I wonder what your uncle will make of this extraordinary account when he reads it." Leon's uncle was Colonel Penrod Ballantyne, the regimental commander. He was many years younger than Snell, but he already outranked him by a wide margin. Snell knew that before he himself was forced into retirement, Ballantyne would probably be promoted to general and given command of a full division in some pleasant part of the empire. After that, a knighthood would follow as a matter of course. "General Sir Penrod Bloody Ballantyne," Snell thought. He hated the man, and hated his bloody nephew, standing before him now. All his life he had been passed over while men like Ballantyne had soared effortlessly over his head. "Well, I can't do much about the old dog," he thought grimly, "but this pup is a different matter entirely." He scratched his head with the stem of his pipe. "Tell me, Courtney, do you understand why I have had you detained since you arrived back in barracks?" "Sir?" Leon stared at the wall above his head. "In case that should mean no, sir, I would like to run through the events you describe in this report and point out those that have given me concern. Do you have any objections?" "Sir, no, sir." "Thank you, Lieutenant. On the 16th of July, you were ordered to take under your command a detachment of 7 men and to proceed immediately to the District Commissioner's headquarters at Niombe and take up guard duties to protect the station against possible forays by Nandi rebels. That is correct, is it not? Sir, yes, sir. As ordered, you left these barracks on the 16th, but you and your detachment did not reach Niombe until 12 days later, although you travelled by rail as far as Mushy Siding. This left you a march of less than 120 miles to Niombe. So it seems that you covered the distance at the rate of less than 10 miles a day. Snell looked up from the report. That could hardly be described as a forced march, do you agree? Sir, I have explained the reason in my report. Leon was still standing to attention and staring at the nicotine-speckled wall above Snell's head. Ah, yes. You came across the tracks of a large war party of Nandi rebels and decided, in your infinite wisdom, to disregard your orders to proceed to Niombe, but rather to follow up and engage the rebels. I hope I have read your explanation correctly. Yes, sir. Please explain to me, Lieutenant, how you knew that these tracks were those of a war party and not simply those of hunters from a tribe other than the Nandi or refugees fleeing from the area of the uprising. Sir, I was advised by my sergeant that they were those of Nandi rebels. You accepted his evaluation? Yes, sir. Sergeant Manyoro is an expert tracker. So you spent 6 days following up these mythical insurgents. Sir, they were moving directly towards the mission station at Nakuru. It seemed they might be intent on attacking and destroying the settlement. I thought it my duty to prevent them doing so. Your duty was to obey orders. Be that as it may, the fact is that you never managed to catch up. Sir, the Nandi became aware that we were in pursuit, broke up into smaller parties and scattered into the bush. I turned back and proceeded to Niombe. As you had been ordered? Yes, sir. Of course, Sergeant Manyoro is not in a position to corroborate your version of events. I have merely your word, Snell went on. Sir, so to continue, Snell glanced down at the report, you broke off the pursuit and at long last made for Niombe. Sir, when you reached the Boma, you discovered that while you had been wandering around the countryside, the district commissioner and his family had been massacred. Immediately after this discovery, you then realized you had led your detachment negligently into a Nandi ambush. You turned tail and ran, leaving your men to fend for themselves. That is not what happened, sir. Leon was unable to disguise his outrage. And that outburst was insubordination, Lieutenant. Snell relished the word, rolling it around his mouth as though he was tasting a fine claret. I apologize, sir. It was not intended as such. I assure you, Courtney, that it was taken thus. However, you disagree with my evaluation of the events at Niombe. Have you witnesses to support your version? Sergeant Manyoro, sir.
Ah, of course.
I had forgotten how, when you left Niombe, you placed the sergeant on your back and, outrunning a rebel army, carried him southwards into Maasai land. Snell sneered luxuriously. It should be remarked at this point that you took him in the opposite direction from Nairobi, then left him with his mother. His mother, forsooth, Snell chuckled. How touching. He lit his pipe and puffed at it. The relief party that reached the Niombe Boma many days after the massacre found that all the corpses of your men had been so mutilated by the rebels that it was impossible to identify them with any certainty, especially as those who had not been decapitated had been largely devoured by vultures and hyena. I think you left your sergeant among those corpses, rather than with his mother, as you avow. I believe that after you deserted the battlefield, you skulked in the wilderness until you were able to recover your nerve sufficiently to return to Nairobi with this cock-and-bull story. No, sir. Leon was trembling with anger, and his fists were bunched at his sides so that the knuckles showed bone-white. Since joining the battalion, you have displayed a fine contempt for military discipline and authority. You have shown a much greater interest in such frivolous activity as polo and big game hunting than in the duties of a junior subaltern. It is clear that you consider those duties beneath your dignity. Not only that, You have disregarded the decent demands of social convention. You have taken to yourself the role of a lascivious Lothario, outraging the decent folk of the colony.
Major, sir, I don't see how you can substantiate those accusations.
Substantiate? Very well, I will substantiate. You are probably unaware that during your prolonged absence in Masai Land, the governor of the colony has seen fit to repatriate a young widow to England to protect her from your depredations. The entire community of Nairobi is outraged by your behaviour. You are, sir, a confounded rogue with respect for nothing and no one.
Repatriated?
Leon turned ashen under the filth and his tan.
They have sent Verity home? Ah, so you acknowledge the poor woman's identity. Yes, Mrs. O'Hearn has gone back to England. She left a week ago.
Snell paused to let it sink in. He gloated at the knowledge that he himself had brought the sordid affair to the governor's attention. He had always found Verity O'Hearn devilishly attractive. After the death of her husband, he had often fantasized about comforting and protecting her in her bereavement. From a distance, he had gazed at her longingly when she sat on the front lawn of the Settlers' Club, taking tea with his wife and other members of the Women's Institute. She was so young, lovely, and gay, and Maggie Snell sitting beside her so old, ugly, and crabby. When he had heard whispers of her involvement with one of his subalterns, he was devastated. Then he became extremely angry. Verity O'Hearn's virtue and reputation were in danger, and it was his duty to protect her. He had gone to the governor.
"Well, Courtney, I do not intend to substantiate my allegations any further. All will be decided at your court-martial. Your dossier has been handed to Captain Roberts of 2nd Battalion. He has agreed to act as prosecuting officer. Eddie Roberts was one of Snell's favourites. The charges against you will be desertion, cowardice, dereliction of duty, and failing to obey the orders of a superior officer. Second Lieutenant Sampson of the same battalion has agreed to defend you. I know that the two of you are friendly, so I do not expect you to object to my choice. There's been some difficulty in finding three officers to make up the court. Naturally, I am unable to sit on the panel, as I will be required to give evidence during the proceedings, and most officers are in the field against the last of the rebels. Fortunately, a P&O liner docked in Mombasa over the weekend, carrying a group on leave from India en route for Southampton. I've arranged that a colonel and two captains will travel up from Mombasa by train to Nairobi to make up a full panel of judges. They are due to arrive at 1800 hours this evening. They will have to return to Mombasa by Friday to continue their voyage, so the proceedings must commence tomorrow morning. I will send Lieutenant Sampson to your quarters immediately to consult with you and to prepare your defence. You're in a sorry state, Courtney. I can smell you from where I sit. Go and get yourself cleaned up and be ready to appear before the court for arraignment first thing tomorrow morning. Until then, you are confined to your quarters.
I request an interview with Colonel Ballantyne, sir. I need an extension of time to prepare my defence.
Unfortunately, Colonel Ballantyne is not in Nairobi at the moment. He is in the Nandi tribal lands with 1st Battalion, making reprisals for the Naombe massacre, and stamping out the last of the rebel resistance. It is unlikely that he will return to Nairobi for several weeks. When he does, I am certain he will take cognizance of your request.
Snell smiled coldly.
That is all. Prisoner, dismiss. Guard detail, attention,
barked Sergeant Major Mfefi.
About 10. Quick, march. Left, right, left.
Leon found himself out in the brilliant sunshine of the parade ground, being marched at double time towards the officers' billets. Everything was moving so swiftly that he had difficulty in ordering his thoughts. Leon's quarters were a rondavel, a single-roomed building with a circular mud-daub wall and a thatched roof. It stood in the centre of a row of identical huts. Each was occupied by an unmarried officer. At his door, Sergeant Major Mfethi saluted Leon smartly and said softly but awkwardly in Kiswahili,
"I am sorry this has happened, Lieutenant. I know you are no coward."
Mfethi had never in 25 years of service been required to arrest and place under guard one of his own officers. He felt ashamed and humiliated.
Even though most of Leon's company turned out to cheer his performance in any cricket or polo match, and when they saluted him it was always with a sparkling African grin, he was only superficially aware of his popularity among the other ranks, so he was moved by the Sergeant Major's words. Mfefe went on hurriedly to cover his embarrassment. "After you left on patrol, a lady came to the main gates and left a box for you, Bwana. She told me to make sure you received it. I put it in your room next to the bed." "Thank you, Sergeant Major." Leon was equally embarrassed. He turned away and went into the sparsely furnished hut. It contained an iron bedstead with a mosquito net suspended over it from a rafter, a single shelf and a wardrobe made from an old packing case. It was scrupulously clean and tidy. The walls had been recently lime-washed and the floor gleamed with a coating of beeswax. His scant possessions were arranged with geometrical precision on the shelf above his bed. During his absence, Ishmael, his manservant, had been as meticulous as ever. The only item out of place was the long leather case that was propped against the wall. Leon crossed to the bed and sat down. He felt close to despair. So many disasters had struck him at once. Almost without conscious volition, he reached out for the leather case Mfefe had left for him and laid it across his lap. It was made of travel-scarred but expensive leather, covered with steamship labels, and fitted with three solid brass locks, whose keys were attached by a thong to the handle. He unlocked it, lifted the lid, and stared in astonishment at the contents. Nestled in the fitted green baize compartments were the components of a heavy rifle, with, in their own tailored slots, the ramrod, oil can, and other accessories. On the underside of the lid, a large label bore the name of the gunmaker printed in ornate script. Holland and Holland, manufacturers of guns, rifles, pistols, and every description of breech-loading firearms. 98 New Bond Street, London W. With a sense of reverence, Leon reassembled the rifle, fitting the barrels into the action and clamping them in position with the forestock. He stroked the oil-finished wood of the butt, the polished walnut silky smooth under his fingertips. He lifted the rifle and aimed it at a small gecko that hung upside down on the far wall. The butt fitted perfectly into his shoulder, and the barrels aligned themselves under his eye. He held the bead of the foresight in the wide V of the rear express sight, rock steady on the lizard's head. "Bang, bang, you're dead," he told it, and laughed for the first time since he had returned to barracks. He lowered the weapon and read the engraving on the barrels. H&H Royal .470 Nitro Express. Then the pure gold oval inlay let into the walnut of the butt caught his eye. It was engraved with the initials of the original owner. P-O-apostrophe-H. "Patrick O'Hearn," he murmured. The magnificent weapon had belonged to Verity's dead husband. An envelope was pinned to the green baize of the lid beside the maker's label. He set down the rifle carefully on the pillow at the head of his bed and reached for it. He split the seal with his thumbnail and pulled out two folded sheets of paper. The first was a receipt dated the 29th of August, 1906. "To whom it may concern, I have this day sold the H&H .470 rifle with serial number 1863 to Lieutenant Leon Courtney and have received from him the sum of 25 guineas in full and final payment. Signed, Verity Abigail O'Hearn." With this document, Verity had transferred the rifle legally into his name so that nobody could contest his ownership. He folded the receipt and returned it to the envelope. Then he opened the other sheet of paper. It was undated, and the handwriting was scrawled and uneven, unlike that on the receipt. Her pen had twice left splashes of ink on the page. It was obvious that she had been in a state of upheaval when she had written it. "Dearest, dearest Leon, by the time you read this, I will be on my way back to Ireland. I did not want to go, but I have been given little choice. Deep in my heart, I know that the person who is sending me away is right, and it is for the best. Next year I will be 30 years old,
and you are just 19 and a very junior subaltern. I am sure that one day you will be a famous general covered with medals and glory, but by then I'll be an old maid. I have to go. This gift I leave you is an earnest of my affection for you. Go and forget me. Find happiness somewhere else. I will always hold you in my memory as I once held you in my arms. It was signed V. His vision blurred, and his breathing was uneven as he reread the letter. Before he reached the last line, there was a polite knock on the door of his rendezvous. "Who is it?" he called.
"It is me, Effendi."
"Just a minute, Ishmael." Quickly he wiped his eyes on the back of his forearm, placed the letter under his pillow, and packed the rifle back into its case. He pushed it under the bed and called, "Come in, beloved of the Prophet." Ishmael, who was a devout coastal Swahili, came in with a zinc bathtub balanced on his head.
"Welcome back, Effendi. You bring the sun into my heart."
He set the tub in the centre of the floor, then set about filling it with steaming buckets of water from the fireplace behind the hut. While the water cooled to a bearable temperature, Ishmael whipped a sheet round Leon's neck, and then, with comb and scissors, took up position behind him and began to snip at Leon's sweat and dust-caked hair. He worked with practiced skill, and when he had finished, he stood back and nodded, satisfied, then fetched the shaving mug and brush. He worked up a creamy lather over Leon's stubble, then stropped the long blade of the straight razor and handed it to his master. He held the small hand mirror while Leon scraped his jaw clean, then wiped away the last traces of soap.
"How does that look?" Leon asked. "Your beauty would blind the Hurs of Paradise, Effendi,"
Ishmael said solemnly, and tested the bath water with one finger.
"It is ready."
Leon stripped off his stinking rags and threw them against the far wall, then went to the steaming bath and lowered himself into it with a sigh of pleasure. The bath was hardly large enough to accommodate him, and he sat with his knees under his chin. Ishmael gathered up his soiled clothing, holding it ostentatiously at arm's length, and carried it away. He left the door open behind him. Without knocking, Bobby Sampson ambled in. "A thing of beauty is a joy for ever," he said with a diffident grin. Bobby was only a year older than Leon. He was a large, gawky, but affable youth, and as the two most junior officers in the regiment, he and Leon had formed a friendship that had at its core the instinct for survival. They had sealed their friendship with the joint purchase of a dilapidated and road-beaten Vauxhall truck from a Hindu coffee grower for the sum of £3.10, almost their total combined savings. By working until all hours of the night, they had restored it to an approximation of its former glory. Bobby went to the bed and dropped onto it, placed his hands behind his head, crossed his ankles, and contemplated the gecko, which had climbed into the rafters and now hung upside down above him.
"Well, old man, you seem to have got yourself into a bit of a pickle, what? I'm sure you know by now that Freddy the Frog is accusing you of all sorts of mischief and wrongdoing. Quite by chance, I happen to have with me a copy of the charge sheet."
He reached into the large side pocket of his uniform jacket and brought out a crumpled ball of papers. He smoothed them out on his chest, then waved them at Leon.
"Some pretty colourful stuff here. I'm impressed with your naughtiness. Trouble is, I've been ordered to defend you. What? What?"
"For God's sake, Bobby, stop saying what. You know it drives me mad." Bobby put on an expression of contrition.
"Sorry, old boy. Truth is, I haven't the faintest idea what I'm supposed to be doing."
"Bobby, you are an idiot."
"Can't help it, me old beauty. Mother must have dropped me on me head, don't you know? Anyway, back to the main item on the agenda. Have you any idea what I'm supposed to be doing?"
"You're supposed to bedazzle the judges with your wit and erudition." Leon was beginning to feel more cheerful. He enjoyed the way Bobby hid his astute mind behind a bumbling facade.
"Bit depleted in the wit and erudition department at the moment," Bobby admitted. "What else is there?"
Leon rose from the bath, splashing soapy water over the floor. Bobby balled up the towel Ishmael had left on the end of the bed and threw it at his head.
"For a start, let's read through the charges together," Leon suggested as he toweled himself.
Bobby brightened.
"Brilliant idea. Always suspected you of being a genius."
Leon pulled on a pair of khaki trousers.
"Bit short of seating in here," he said. "Move your fat ass."
Bobby sat up, serious now. He made room for his friend on the bed, and Leon settled beside him. Together they pored over the charge sheet. When the light in the hut faded, Ishmael brought in a bullseye lamp and hung it on its hook. They worked on by its feeble yellow light, until at last Bobby rubbed his eyes and yawned, then pulled out his half-hunter and wound it vigorously. "It's well past midnight, and you and I have to be in court at 9 o'clock. We'll have to call it a day. By the way, would you like to know what I think of your chances of acquittal?"
"Not really," Leon answered.
"If you offered me odds of 1,000 to 1, I wouldn't risk tuppence halfpenny," Bobby told him.
"If only we could find the sergeant of yours, the story might have a different ending."
"Fat chance of that happening before 9 o'clock tomorrow. Manyoro's on top of a mountain in Maasai land, hundreds of miles away.